headlines, a fresh warning from Yemeni forces to foreign investors operating in the UAE. Leave the country immediately. Calls growing in Afghanistan for justice to be served in the case of a U.S. drone strike that wiped out an entire family in Kabul. Beijing says Washington's decision to suspend dozens of flights by Chinese airlines is not guided by reason. Welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. A spokesman for the Yemeni army is warning foreign companies operating in the United Arab Emirates to leave the country amid an escalation of airstrikes. Yahya Sari says the UAE is no longer safe and investing there is highly risky for foreign firms. He says the UAE will remain unsafe as long as it continues to attack Yemen as part of a Saudi-led military coalition. The warning comes on the heels of a major drone strike by Yemeni forces deep inside the UAE last week. The retaliatory raid targeted three fuel tankers in Abu Dhabi, killing at least three people. Following the operation, the Saudi-led coalition launched hundreds of airstrikes on Yemen, hitting mainly civilian targets. Journalist and political commentator Bahishta Yonkers says the Yemeni army wants to cripple the UAE's economy to stop the aggression on the country.
The reason why Yemen does give such a warning against foreign investors in particular is because Yemen knows very well how to wage this war against a country such as the UAE. The UAE is a hub of international commerce and international trade, and in fact, without international global finance, this country would not prosper, would barely even, you know, exist as a modern state. So they know that Yemen doesn't have to destroy the United Arab Emirates, nor do they have any interest. But what they can do is hit them where it hurts, and that is in their pockets, in their wallets, in their finances. And when the UAE will be considered, if the UAE would be considered an unsafe country for investment, an unsafe country for commerce, for trade, then the entire premise upon which this country has been built up since the 1980s, basically, will collapse, because there will no longer be any possibility for the UAE to prosper as a hub of international trade and international finance. And this is something that the Yemeni people and the Yemeni resistance knows very well, and that's also why when they struck Abu Dhabi last week, they did not strike a target that is necessarily of military consequence. They did not strike a target that will maximize the amount of casualties or would kill the most amount of soldiers. What they struck was oil tankers. What they struck were areas that are of strategic economical importance.
Condemnations were pouring in over the Saudi-led coalition's deadly airstrikes on Yemen, with the UN chief describing the attacks as unacceptable.
Now, any bombardment that targets civilians or that is not careful enough to protect civilians is, of course, also unacceptable.
Guterres called for a prompt, effective, and transparent investigation into the airstrikes, which left dozens dead. Former leader of the UK Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, also censored the attacks and called for an end to arms sales to Saudi Arabia. He said they make London a complicit in Saudi crimes. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah also condemned the raids as terrifying. It said the Saudi-led coalition's attacks are aimed at covering up its failure on the battlefield. Meanwhile, Iraq's resistance groups in separate statements denounced the airstrikes as a massacre of Yemeni civilians. Meanwhile, Yemen's health minister says the death toll from the Saudi-led coalition's latest airstrike on the country has risen to at least 82. According to the minister, another 266 people have been injured in the Saudi strikes, with many of them being in critical condition. Saudi warplanes bombed a prison in the northern city of Saada in the early hours of Friday, killing dozens of people. At least three children also died in a separate air raid on telecommunications facilities in the western city of Hodeidah. The attack led to a nationwide internet blackout. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015, killing hundreds of thousands there. And no punishment yet for U.S. military personnel behind a deadly drone strike in Afghanistan just days before their withdrawal from that country in August last year. Now, many Afghans, including the victims' relatives, want the Kabul strike to be regarded as a war crime. The U.S. drone strike left 10 Afghan civilians, including 7 children, dead. The U.S. military initially defended the attack, claiming the target was Daesh terrorists, but the Pentagon ultimately called it a tragic mistake following the release of the airstrike's video by the Central Command. Until now, no one has been held accountable for the carnage. Afghans say that the U.S. military had acknowledged such strikes as mistakes in the past, but their perpetrators were never brought to justice. Tens of thousands of civilians were killed by U.S. forces during their two-decade presence in Afghanistan. David McBride is a former Australian Army legal officer. He tells us why the United States tried to cover its April drone strike in Afghanistan.
There has to be a question that the Americans are covering up their crimes. And when they say, oh, there was no misconduct, they're not saying that in good faith. They're saying the lives of Afghans don't really matter, and we are not going to punish our people even if they do the wrong thing. I suspect that they needed to, for political reasons and the embarrassment the withdrawal had caused for the American administration, meant that the leadership of the American military were desperate to kill somebody and to make it look like they were fighting terrorists, and they got found out. I don't think that there was any real... there can't be, under the rules of engagement, that could not have been a legal strike.
Iran warns Israel is exploiting the United Nations mechanisms and other international bodies to cover up its daily crimes against Palestinians. In a statement, Iran's foreign ministry stressed that the regime has always tried to use the victims of crimes in the Second World War to justify its atrocities against Palestinians. The ministry said the regime has subjected Palestinians to all sorts of violations, especially crimes against humanity. It said genocide, terror, and ethnic cleansing are just some of the crimes that the regime is committing against Palestinians. The ministry further stressed that Israel maintains the same racist and expansionist ideology that triggered the crimes committed during the Second World War. Moving on, China and the United States are at odds again, this time on the suspension of each other's flights. The U.S. has suspended 44 flights by Chinese carriers, with the Transportation Department saying the move is in response to a similar decision by China. In recent weeks, Beijing suspended 44 flights by American Airlines after detecting positive COVID cases. Now the Chinese embassy in Washington says such policy has been applied equally to Chinese and foreign airlines in a fair, open, and transparent way. The embassy says the U.S. measure is unreasonable, urging Washington to stop disrupting normal passenger flights. The two countries are at loggerheads on other issues, including the coronavirus origin, as well as trade and politics. A lawmaker from Britain's ruling Conservative Party says he will meet police to discuss the accusations he has leveled against Prime Minister Boris Johnson's government. William Ray has accused the government of seeking to blackmail parliamentarians suspected of trying to force the Prime Minister from office. Ray says some conservatives had faced intimidation from government representatives because of their desire to topple Johnson. The Prime Minister has said that there is no evidence to support Ray's claims. Boris Johnson has been on the hot seat following revelations about parties in his Downing Street residence during COVID lockdowns. The scandal followed criticism of the UK government's handling of the corruption row and other missteps that has drained public support for both Johnson and his party. And tensions between the U.S. and Russia over Ukraine show no sign of abating, despite a meeting between the foreign ministers of the two countries. We discuss that in our news review program. Let's have the full story and our guests' views on that subject.
Russian Foreign Minister has once again dismissed Western claims that Moscow is planning to invade Ukraine. Sergey Lavrov made the remarks after a high-stakes meeting with his U.S. counterpart, Antony Blinken, in Geneva.
I would like to reiterate once again, at the end of our meeting, we agreed that next week the U.S. is going to present us with written answers to all of our proposals. And you also said, in particular, that Ukraine represents no threat to Russia. And I would like to once again remind everyone who analyzes our public statements and our analysis, and I would like to say that never before has Russia threatened through its official representatives, the Ukrainian people.
Lavrov said talks with Blinken were open and useful. He added that Russia is concerned about weapons and Western military experts being sent to Ukraine, accusing NATO of working against his country. U.S.-Russia meeting comes amid rising tensions over Ukraine. U.S. and its allies say that Russia is planning to use over 100,000 troops deployed near the Ukrainian border for an invasion. Russia, in turn, has accused the West of plotting provocations in Ukraine. Russia wants binding security guarantees, including a permanent ban on Ukrainian membership into NATO. The U.S. and military alliance have rejected the demand, warning that any attack on Ukraine will have costly consequences.
We've been clear. If any Russian military forces move across Ukraine's border, that's a renewed invasion. It will be met with swift, severe, and a united response from the United States and our partners and allies.
We also know from experience.
Antony Blinken described his discussions with Lavrov as frank and substantive. He said the U.S. and its European allies stand firmly with Ukraine in support of its sovereignty and territorial integrity. Blinken also vowed a decisive, calibrated, and united response to any non-military Russian aggression, including cyber attacks and paramilitary tactics. He said the U.S. is prepared to pursue possible means of addressing Russian concerns in the spirit of reciprocity. Blinken reiterated that he hadn't expected Washington and Moscow to resolve their differences in this meeting, but hopes to keep a diplomatic path to address issues still open. Joining us now for the program is Mr. Scott Bennett, former U.S. Army Psychological Warfare Officer, joining us out of San Francisco, California, and Sarah Flounders from the International Action Center, joining us from New York. Hello, and I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess, Ms. Flounders, we'll start with you. Hope you're safe and doing well out there in New York. Your thoughts on this meeting and subsequent meetings and the fact that why are we still at an impasse at this point with respect to the tensions at hand?
Well, we're at an impasse, and we got to know who's responsible for this crisis. Now, just a couple weeks ago, Russian President Putin made it absolutely clear, drew the line. He said, we have to make it clear any further movement of NATO to the east is unacceptable. And this is what the U.S. is consciously violating with NATO. Putin asked, are we deploying missiles near the U.S. border? No, we are not. It is the United States that has come to our home with its missiles and is already standing on our doorstep. Is it going too far to demand that no strike systems be placed near our home? What's so unusual about this? Now, that really sums up who is creating this crisis by encouraging Ukraine's membership into NATO by moving all sorts of missile batteries and weapons and much more planned into the Ukraine, and even into organizing the fascist coup that overthrew the elected government in Ukraine in 2014, which at the time, Assistant Secretary of State Nuland bragged that the U.S. had spent more than $5 billion to do this with organizations, with social media, and so on. So here you have a stage-managed crisis to expand NATO right to Russia's doorstep. And Russia is moving troops within its own borders. What's wrong with that? Absolutely nothing.
And Scott, why is it out of the question when this it's so important, and NATO is already close enough to Russia's borders without Ukraine's inclusion, without going that far east right up to Russia's doorsteps? It's practically in a couple countries very close right up at Russia's doorsteps. They're just saying no more. Why is that out of the question for Washington and its allies at this point in the game to entertain?
Well, Russia and NATO look at this from different vantage points. Russia looks at it from a military defensive vantage point. It does not want weapons that close to its border, whereas NATO looks at the Ukrainian membership as simply an economic, extension of its lifeline. NATO is a defunct organization. It has no purpose, and that's why they have to absorb Ukraine to give it fresh breath, fresh life, and an appearance of solidarity and significance when it has none. If I was Russia, I would be engaging in all sorts of conversations, phone calls, emails, diplomatic trips to Mexico, to Canada, to South American countries, Caribbean islands, with every topic from naval bases to training operations, joint training operations. I would be flooding the NSA and the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency's computer networks with chatter and traffic that Russia is on a full-born joint military expansionary agenda with China and Iran as its recent military practice sessions and training exercises with Iran and China demonstrate.
Thank you both. Always a pleasure to check in with both of you. Mr. Scott Bennett there joining us from San Francisco, California, pardon, and Sarah Flanders there from the International Action Center joining us out of New York. That's a wrap for the segment of your news review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyr Soleimani will live on forever and his enemies will disappear in history's dustbin. January 5th, 2022.
امروز هم مستکبران از نام او وحشت دارن از یاد او وحشت دارن میبینید تو فضای مجازی اطلاع دارید حد بیشتر از من نبود که چه برخوردی دارن با اسم او میکنن
Today too the arrogant powers are intimidated by the name and memory of Shahid Qasem Soleimani. Notice how they are treating his name on the internet. You probably have more information than me in this regard. This is another alert and even more of a signal for us and for the officials in charge of matters related to the internet in the country for them to understand what they should do in order to prevent the enemy from doing whatever he wants on the internet wherever he wants. Well, the internet which exists in the world today is in the hands of the arrogant powers. They are even afraid of his name, and they are terrified of there being more people like him. This is what a role model is. They are afraid more people will be like him.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
او شهید سلیمانی موندنی است تا ابد زنده است. اونایی که او رو شهید کردن، ترامپ و امثال او، جاشون زبالدان تاریخه.
In any case, Shahid Soleimani is eternal and will live on forever. Those who martyred him, Trump and the likes, belong to the dustbin of history. They will be among the forgotten ones in the trash can of history. But he will live on forever. A martyr is like this. His enemies will disappear, but of course, after having received retribution in this world for their crime, inshallah. I hope all of you, his honorable family, his friends and colleagues, and Mr. Qa'ani, who is working and moving forward very well, praise God, will follow and move forward on this path, inshallah. God the Exalted has promised victory to us. Allah indeed defends those who have faith. The Holy Quran, Surah 22, verse 38. He has promised to defend those who believe. Well, we are moving on the path of the divine will and divine goals. And the nation is working for Islam. This is the promise of defense. There is another promise about assistance. Allah will surely help those who help his cause. إِن تَنْصُرُ اللَّهَ يَنْصُرُكُمْ وَيُثَبِّتْ أَقْدَامَكُمْ. The Holy Quran, Surah 22, verse 40. And in another verse it stated, if you help Allah, he will help you and make your feet steady. The Holy Quran, Surah 47, verse 7. I hope that all of you will be successful, inshallah. The activities that this woman spoke about, Zainab Soleimani, the daughter of Martyr Soleimani, are good activities. I hope all these activities will continue in the best way, inshallah. May God's greetings, mercy, and blessings be upon you.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Britain's Prince William has been condemned for the comments he recently made against the surge in Africa's population and its alleged impact on wildlife. Now, this senior member of the British royal family made similar claims in 2017. Let's take a listen.
In my lifetime, we have seen global wildlife populations decline by over half. Africa's rapidly growing human population is predicted to more than double by 2050, a staggering increase of 3.5 million people per month. There is no question that this increase puts wildlife and habitats under enormous pressure.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. It's always great having you watch our show. Today we are focusing on racist remarks by Britain's Prince William to the effect that the increasing population in Africa threatens wildlife. Now, his comments have attracted widespread criticism. In the second part of our program, we shall talk about the decision by the United States to impose trade sanctions on Ethiopia, Mali, and Guinea over claims of human rights violations and recent coups. Stay tuned till the end of our show as our experts analyze today's topics.
Prince William's racist view on Africans. Britain's Prince William recently repeated his position regarding what he termed as the pressure put on Africa's wildlife by human populations. In a speech last November at the Tusk Conservation Awards, he stated that the increasing pressure on Africa's wildlife and wild spaces as a result of human population presents a huge challenge for conservationists, as it does the world over. The comments have been made while Prince William is the father of three children, leading to accusations of hypocrisy. The remarks by Prince William continue to attract harsh criticism from many people in Africa. Here's one such comment on Twitter by Dr. John Njenga. He says, "Mr. William has no moral authority to say anything about Africa or about Africans and their lives. He should spend his time reading good history books and raising his many children and spending time with his very huge family spread out across the world."
Now, for more on this subject, we contacted Professor Firoz Manji, an author, activist, and a professor of African studies at Carleton University. He's also a publisher at Daraja Press. Now, Professor, can we say that Prince William has a colonial mentality which still views Africans as colonial subjects?
Well, come on, you know, we're talking about a social parasite, you know, who lives on not only the wealth of taxpayers in the UK, but a whole inheritance of a family which has been deeply involved in enslavement, in slavery, in the riches from all that period, a family that has an enormous wealth in all the British former British colonies. In fact, people like Prince William and the royal family and so on, and a lot of these whites, white settlers in Africa, care more about preserving animals than they are about humans. For them, human beings are purely disposable.
Critics say the greatest source of harm to the fauna on the African continent was European hunters in the early 20th century. Even to this day, European and American tourists continue to illegally hunt African wildlife. Just to give an example, an American trophy hunter killed a famous Zimbabwean lion, igniting outrage across the world. Walter Palmer, a dentist and hunter, killed Cecile the lion outside Zimbabwe's Hwange National Park in July 2015. Here's the reaction of a Zimbabwean tourism official.
Cecile was an icon who was 13 years old and very well known by the international community. The reason why we are very disturbed and rattled by this development is that a lot of people travel long distances coming to Zimbabwe for the purposes of coming to enjoy our wildlife. And obviously the absence of Cecile, it's a disaster in terms of the disappointment it has caused and its absence in the industry, because it's one of the draw cards which really relied upon in the industry.
Now, European hunters entered Africa during the colonial period, and that is when the destruction of African wildlife started. Yet, Prince William blames African population growth for the shrinking wildlife. Now, Professor Manji, what's your take on this?
Well, you know, it is the royal family, Prince William's, and it is their collaboration with the transnational corporations who've stolen most of the land, and which means that there is very little land left indeed for humans, but also for animals. And the reality is, I mean, if we talk about hunters, let's not forget that the royal family were deeply embedded from Elizabethan times in hunting for slaves, killing for slaves, destroying civilizations for slaves. This was a hugely profitable enterprise. These were the original hunters of humans.
Now, illegal logging in Cameroon, the largest exporter of tropical timber to Europe, is posing a real threat to the country's forests that are its most valuable economic and ecological resource. Now, Professor Manji, you mentioned about land grabbed by European multinationals in Africa, leaving little for humans and wildlife. Can you elaborate further on this, please?
They destroy large amounts of land in order to privatize it. And we've seen this continuity under neocolonialism, under the structural adjustment programs of the World Bank and IMF and so on. What you see now is even greater grabbing of land.
High consumption in rich, developed countries is driving forest destruction in many parts of Africa. Ancient forests are being destroyed to plant crops or raw material destined for Europe. For instance, to satisfy the European appetite for chocolate, massive forests have been destroyed in Ivory Coast to clear the way for cocoa plantations. According to estimates, in the last 50 years, the country has lost 90% of its forest cover. Cocoa was the main reason for this destruction. Why did Prince William conveniently ignore the fact the European consumption habits are responsible for the destruction of wildlife habitat in Africa?
The paradigm of these racists, and because let's be quite clear, his whole framework is fundamentally racist, is to always blame the blacks. It's always blaming Africans.
Many agree that capitalism greed leads to the pollution of our air and water, soil degradation, deforestation, and the destruction of biodiversity.
The first step is to recognize that regardless of what particular variety of capitalism you're facing, capitalism is destroying the living planet. And if it's a sort of social democratic capitalism, it might take a few years longer than if it's a neoliberal capitalism. But it's still heading in exactly the same direction.
According to the United Nations, Africa only contributes 2-3% of the world's carbon dioxide emissions. Yet Prince William says African population growth is responsible for environmental destruction. Now, Professor Manji, what's your opinion on these?
Well, it's clearly wrong. It's not what is causing environmental destruction. The scale of environmental destruction carried out by mining companies, for example, especially Canadian mining companies across Africa, have huge impact in towards creating the conditions.
Now, the remarks by Prince William are not the first by a European leader. Now, in 2017, French President Emmanuel Macron faced backlash for talking about Africa having a civilizational problem because women are having 7 or 8 children. Now, Professor Manji, do you think the remarks by these European leaders are part of a long-term imperialist strategy of depopulation in African countries?
Absolutely. I mean, we have seen so many examples of the use of things like Depo-Provera, enforced sterilization. This is not something that's in the past. It is going on today. Enforced sterilization, often done secretly to women, is something quite outrageous. But it fits within this racist paradigm that you get from the discourse of these social parasites like Prince William, who can only see the fear that they have and that they are part of an inheritance. As I said at the beginning, his wealth comes from a long line of enslavement of humans, you know, and that was a massive, massive depopulation strategy for Africa.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Manji, for your insights. We now take a short break before the second part of our show that will focus on United States economic sanctions on African countries refusing to toe Washington's line. Stay with us.
U.S. trade weapon in Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The United States has cut Ethiopia, Mali, and Guinea out of a duty-free trade program known as the African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA, over alleged human rights violations and recent coups.
Ethiopia's trade ministry said in November it was extremely disappointed by Washington's announcement, saying the move would reverse economic gains and unfairly affect and harm women and children.
For more insight on how the U.S. is using trade agreements to arm twist African countries, we contacted Tunde Osazua, a coordinator for the U.S. Out of Africa Network and a member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Now, the U.S. claims to care for the common people, yet its move against these three African countries will affect ordinary people. This is a classic case of collective punishment, which is common in U.S. foreign policy. Now, what's your take on this U.S. policy?
Absolutely. I think the removal of these countries from the African Growth and Opportunity Act is a form of sanctions. And sanctions are economic warfare that have, you know, devastating human costs. Like you said, you know, it is collective punishment that are part of a strategy of, you know, enforcing compliance. So by design, you know, the removal of these countries, right, like Mali, Guinea, and Ethiopia, that will affect, you know, ordinary people in these countries and, you know, particularly rural women who, you know, work in, you know, manufacturing sectors. They'll be the ones who'll suffer.
Economic sanctions and embargoes have become the tool of choice to respond to governments opposed to the meddling by the United States in their countries. Canadian international criminal law expert John Philpott, in an interview with an Addis Ababa TV network, said the U.S. decision to remove Ethiopia from the African Growth and Opportunity Act privileges is meant to hurt the people and weaken the government of Ethiopia.
U.S. intention is to hurt the people. They want the people to hurt. They apply sanctions around the world and cause terrible suffering, starvation, lack of medicine, and in your country, they want to hurt your country so it's weaker, and so maybe the people will turn against the government. That is their thinking and their plan.
Is the United States using trade with Africa as a tool to spread its imperialist and hegemonic control over African countries?
The U.S. is unparalleled dominance over global finance and trade allows them and their allies to essentially own the world economy. with the complicity of the World Bank, you know, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Trade Organization, that dominance is, you know, reinforced and expanded, and it allows the U.S. to selectively and unilaterally exclude, you know, any country at any time from participating in the global economic system. And so what we're seeing is that, you know, through this African Growth and Opportunity Act, you know, Mali and Guinea and Ethiopia are, you know, being excluded from participating in trade with the U.S. specifically. And, you know, and like I was saying earlier, this is, you know, kind of a form of sanctions. It's, you know, the U.S. And the European favored form of exerting control over the world.
Now, the recent U.S. meddling in Ethiopia, where it was seen as supporting the TPLF rebels, attracted condemnation by Ethiopian officials and the masses. Mali has also adopted a new policy and increased its engagement with Russia and other Eastern countries. Now, can we say that the reason these countries such as Mali and Ethiopia are being targeted by the U.S. sanctions is because of their decision to ignore orders from Washington and other Western countries?
You know, the crime of these countries is, you know, using their own resources to develop their own, you know, social progress rather than following the dictates of the U.S. and following the capitalist path. That's why they're singled out for these sanctions. And I think, you know, we should also understand that sanctions don't defend justice or human rights. They're illegal, they're immoral, and they're really terrorist acts of war that are applied against civilians, right? And inflict the greatest suffering on the most vulnerable, including children, including women, you know, the disabled. And so we should see this for what it is. I mean, I'm not saying that the African Growth and Opportunity Act is, you know, the most ideal arrangement or initiative or relationship between these countries and the U.S., but I think we should see this action as a form of sanctions and understand what those sanctions are.
Ethiopians worldwide responded to the U.S. interference in their country's internal affairs by organizing protests that have clearly angered the Biden administration. Here's one such demonstration in London.
No more!
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 Resist!
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 Prevail!
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 Endure!
Endure!
Resist!
Resist!
Endure!
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 Prevail!
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 Ethiopia!
Ethiopia!
Will prevail!
Will prevail!
Eritrea!
Eritrea!
We have seen Ethiopian protesters vowing to resist U.S. meddling in their country. Can African countries sustain this resistance to U.S. pressure?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the No More movement is a great development. And what I'm aware of is that African people are constantly rising up. They're constantly resisting, even if we don't see that reflected in mainstream media. But I think what we should understand is that, you know, wherever there's oppression, there's resistance, and, you know, there's a lot of, you know, imperialist oppression on the African continent, and so as a result, there's a lot of resistance on the part of African countries, or African people, rather.
The United States has been selective in enforcement of the AGOA violations. This is while previous U.S. regimes have ignored violations committed by other AGOA beneficiaries. Some experts say the U.S. targeting of countries such as Ethiopia could backfire.
And if you really see, the import value from U.S. to Ethiopia is much higher than the export value from Ethiopia to the U.S. It means that U.S., if they close the export market from Ethiopia, we would naturally close the import market from U.S. That means U.S. is at a bigger loss than Ethiopia. You know, in terms of the balance of trade, there is a concept called balance of trade, that is the difference between export and import.
China and Russia are already moving in to fill the U.S. gap in African countries. Do you think Washington's disengagement could be a blessing in disguise?
I think that is very likely. The U.S. is already in decline on the world stage, and moves like this that weaken its relationships with countries on the African continent can only accelerate that decline. The U.S. already lags behind China in terms of trade with the African continent. You know, China's investing heavily in African infrastructure through its Belt and Road Initiative and its forgiving debt that's been demanded by the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. And so if China and now Russia are now increasing their influence in Africa, it's really because Africans see the advantage of having an alternative to the U.S. and to Washington. And I believe that these African countries have every right to do business with their ally themselves, with the states of their choosing.
Now, despite claims by the U.S. that AGOA will bring about change and improve the everyday lives of Africans, poverty remains widespread in the region amid sluggish progress and other mounting shortcomings. Now, Mr. Osazua, what should African countries do to avoid being vulnerable to U.S. pressure, as we have seen in the case of AGOA?
Right, like we need to see really a mass movement, right, for a united Africa. And I think we've already started to see, you know, initiatives on the part of African countries for, you know, greater unity, for unification. But it's really what I would like to see, what I think would be the most useful in terms of fighting back against, you know, U.S. and Western domination, is really, you know, a mass movement for unified socialist Africa that would, you know, really meet the needs of African people in ways that don't rely on initiatives or programs like the African Growth and Opportunity Act, right? Like, Africa should not be dependent on, you know, Western aid or neoliberal development projects like the African Growth and Opportunity Act. We need, you know, initiatives, we need programs, we need development, initiatives that are seeking to improve the lot of African people en masse.
Well, there you have it. Africa needs real unity to avoid dependence on exploitative economic programs such as AGOA imposed by Western countries. Thanks a lot, Mr. Atunde. Well, on that note, we come to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Take care and goodbye for now.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
انسان را Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar. Question: what will be the policy of the government of an Islamic Republic on women's freedom, the fight against illiteracy and the cinema? Imam replies, the Shah has not done anything positive in Iran. Trying to mend the damage he has done will take quite a while. The Shah has given freedom neither to women nor to men. We, however, will give freedom to all. Cinemas under the Shah's regime have been in the service of corruption. In an Islamic Republic, they will have to serve the good of the nation. We will fight illiteracy in the best way possible. January 11, 1979.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Today we are with another program of Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi. We're going to talk about the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the women's role in the society. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has said that I take pride in the honorable Iranian women for undergoing such a revolutionary change that destroyed more than 50 years of evil designs of the foreign plotters and their ignoble associates, including ribald poets, writers, and hired propaganda media. Now, in this part of speech, Imam Khomeini is clearly talking about the goals of non-Muslim or the non-Muslim associations or any state which is a non-Muslim state. The things that exist, which is from the poets, writers, or maybe the media which has been used, it takes humans back to the darkness. It never takes humans towards the lightness of guidance. It never takes human being towards the perfection. Whereas it is Islam which takes us towards the perfection. The program of Islam is to take the mankind towards the perfection. And here Imam Khomeini is being proud of the Iranian Muslim women, the role of women, that it is the woman who stood against this evil state which was before it, and they help their men in order to bring the revolution. And this shows us that in Islam, the role of women is not to just sit at home and to do work at home, or being a lady who just stays at home, who just cooks and take care of the kids. Rather, Islam talks about another perspective. Ya Rabbana salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi sallallahu alayhi. When there is a need outside as a political activist, you need to go out. And this is what Imam Khomeini is also referring here. And he is being proud of the Iranian women who has take part in this revolution and who take part in this movement, and they overthrown the rulership of the king before the Islamic Revolution, the rulership which was taking the people, the Iranian people, towards the darkness. And now, since the Islamic rules are applied in this country, in this state, which is the Islamic Republic of Iran, the people, when they go towards the perfection, the women of this country are those who have played a main role in the perfection of the mankind.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
And welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and especially the people. And as always, we will explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we shall discuss the breach of religious freedom in Indian-controlled Kashmir, vis-à-vis the closure of the region's central mosque and a ban on Muharram processions. And we will look at the recent civilian killings in the northeastern Indian state of Nagaland and why calls are growing louder for the repeal of a controversial law.
The recent civilian killings in India's Nagaland state have reignited the long-running debate over a controversial law that confers armed forces with unbridled powers, prompting the Provincial Legislative Assembly to unanimously pass a resolution calling for its abrogation. The trigger was the killing of 6 coal mine workers early this month in a botched counter-insurgency operation. In the ensuing clashes, 7 more civilians were killed. The incidents sparked widespread protests in Nagaland and fueled calls for the repeal of the law.
On the fateful evening of December the 4th, Indian Army soldiers opened fire at a pickup truck carrying coal miners in Nagaland's Mon district. 6 civilians were killed on the spot. Later that day, 7 more civilians and a soldier died in clashes between people and police. On December the 5th, 1 more civilian was shot dead when angry protesters ambushed an army camp. Army soldiers had apparently mistaken the group of coal miners for insurgents. India's Home Minister Amit Shah said the government regretted what he called the unfortunate incident, describing civilian killings as the case of mistaken identity. In the days after Shah's statement, angry protesters filled the streets across Nagaland and adjoining states, demanding the minister's apology and, more importantly, calling for the repeal of Armed Forces Special Powers Act, a draconian law that provides grounds for men in uniform in India's so-called disturbed areas to commit horrendous human rights abuses. On December the 20th, the Nagaland State Assembly unanimously passed a resolution demanding that the BJP government at centre repeal the controversial and much-abused law from the state and from the rest of the northeast. It also demanded that the appropriate authority issue an apology for the massacre and that justice be delivered to the perpetrators.
It's not the first instance that the Armed Forces Special Powers Act has hogged headlines for the wrong reasons. The controversial law, enacted in 1958 to maintain control and curb insurgency in what the Indian government considered disturbed areas, is in force in at least 5 Indian states. The legislation has drawn flak from national and international human rights watchdogs as it gives unbridled powers and immunity to the armed personnel to shoot, kill, make arrests on flimsy pretexts, conduct searches without warrant, and demolish structures.